You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight is the second in our three-part series with our special guest, Mr. Party. Mr. Party of the famous Boston Tea Party. The man who put together, wrote, edited, and published Goodbye, April 15th.
That's right.
Over here giving me all kinds of frantic signals.
Was mic on?
A little
panic.
Well, hey, that's good. Maybe we'll have some more of that. I'm going to sit back tonight, folks, and let Mr. Party have the program. So, stand by. Make sure you have pen and paper by your side, because there are a lot of things that you're going to want to write down. And the first one is the price of his book. $43. You can order it from the Intelligence Service. Post Office Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. That's P.O. Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. Make checks and money orders out to Annie, A-N-N-I-E.
DJ on the radio, the coke and the icebox, popcorn on the table, me and my baby, we're out here on the floor. So Mr. DJ, he's all got the friends, cause I'm a having such a good time, with my baby.
Thank you, Bill. Last night we covered some of the basics of what's known as untaxation, talking about the federal government, how it masquerades itself behind the term United States, what that term means, wages, employee, things like that. But I want to go back to some more fundamentals about all this. So you've got my book in front of you, Goodbye April 15th by Boston Tea Party. Turn to chapter 7, first page of chapter 7, chapter called Your Labor is an Untaxable Right. There's a scripture from Proverbs 27:18. Whoso keepeth the fig tree shall eat the fruit thereof. That's really the only thing we have to remember, the only thing we have to know in our hearts about all this. It says, hey, I work for a living. The fruits of my labor, the sweat from my brow, is mine. No one else has a right to it but God, not governments. And this concept, this sacred idea of labor being property, was recognized and understood by people 100 years ago, but lost. And that's our problem today, that we forgot that labor and wages are ours. We have a right to them 100%. I talk about this in all of chapter 7. The courts, up until probably the 30s or so, would recognize this as well. I'm talking about why your labor is sacred property, it's not taxable. And they covered the principles of this quite well. There's a case in 1884 called the Butchers Union Company versus Crescent City. And I'll read from this a little bit. The property which every man has is his own labor. As it is the original foundation of all other property, so it is the most sacred and inviolable. The patrimony of the poor man lies in the strength and dexterity of his own hands, and to hinder his employing this strength and dexterity in what manner he thinks proper, without injury to his neighbor, is a plain violation of this most sacred property. A couple of the cases worked on this as well. Grosjean versus American Press Company, 1936, and Murdoch versus Pennsylvania, 1943. Supreme Court also ruled that imposing an excise, which is an indirect tax, upon any unalienable right is unconstitutional. So, what we've got the court saying is you've got a right to work and you've got a right to keep the fruits of your labor. Other cases cover this as well. Redville v. Fisher. The individual's rights to live and his own property are natural rights for the enjoyment of which an excise or indirect tax cannot be imposed. The right to make contracts for sale of one's labor is a liberty that can't be exercised upon. Adair v. United States, 1907. So we've got this. You know labor is the most sacred property. Selling it is your right. So why are you paying taxes on that? Well, you got tricked into it. You didn't know labor was your right, so it was easy to take it away from you. That's why Section 3402P talks about, this is in the Internal Revenue Code, talks about of the IRS. Waiting for that other bullet. There we go. Okay. Since they've outlawed new semi-automatics, we're having to bolt action our weapons now. Anyway, 3402P of the Internal Revenue Code talks about voluntary withholding agreements. You got tricked into it. You didn't know your labor was a right. You thought that it was income. Why, all the other civilized nations of the world have to pay an income tax. We're the last one to have started. Last nation on earth among the civilized nations to have a Social Security program. We still don't have a national health insurance program. You know, we're such rubes and Neanderthals amongst the civilized nations. Well, good. They're the rubes and the Neanderthals compared with respect to individual rights. Okay, getting back to wages, they're not income. They're not income according to the courts. They're not even income according to the Internal Revenue Code.
What was that, a 30-06 or something?
Right on target. The 16th Amendment, I'll read this. Whether or not it was ratified or not properly ratified is moot for this particular discussion. It wasn't. I'll talk about that in Chapter 9. But I'll read it to you. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes, comma, from whatever source derived, comma, without apportionment among the several states, comma, and without regard to any census or enumeration. There were a big slew of court cases after that. Basically, the feds, the Internal Revenue Bureau at the time, was trying to stretch the meaning of income. They were stretching at their chain on their neck, their little leash. So the big slew of court cases about this. What is income? What is not income? This was pretty much settled in Lucas and Eisner. I'll read from Lucas v. Earle, 1930. From the language of the Tax Act of 1913, it is not salaries, wages, or compensation for personal service that are to be included in gross income. The Income Tax Acts, I'm reading from my book now, of 1862, 1864, 65, 66, 67, 1870, 1894, 1913, 1918, 1921, 1924, 28, and 32, income was only referred to as profit or gain. Profit or gain from certain sources, certain activities, basically privileged activities. The government would grant you a license to do something, and their cut from these activities is what they got paid for. You paid income tax on privileges. Working for a living, receiving wages for a living, selling your labor is not a privilege. It's a natural right, as we just talked about. So, income is an accounting profit or gain. Why are you paying income taxes on your wages? Because you've gotten tricked into it. So, we've got Lucas v. Earle to talk about this. We've got Edwards v. Keith, Oliver v. Halstead, Laureldale Cemetery Association v. Matthews, a whole bunch of cases which said you've got a right to work. Reasonable compensation for labor or services rendered is not profit. And we kept the feds at bay on this point pretty much until World War I. I'm turning now to Chapter 9, the 16th Amendment, first page of Chapter 9. Back in 1916, 3 years after the income tax was passed, only 1 in 250 Americans paid income tax. That's 0.4%. 23 years later, in 1939, only 1 in 33 Americans, 1 in 33, that's 3%, paid income tax. However, once the war had started, been in effect for us for a year and a half, by 1942, 1 in 5 Americans, 20%, paid income tax. So this was a patriotic victory tax. It was a wartime measure. It was propagandized. Donald Duck had a lot to do with it in the cartoon with Walt Disney, telling people to go down and get the forms and fill it out and pay income tax. And that's when it really started, about 50 years ago. And that had a lot to do with the Public Salary Wage and Tax Act of 1939. So this fraud, although it started, it has beginnings in 1913, basically got its steam in World War II, with the power of the federal government in war, with the patriotic fervor of the people of the time, and has continued unabated since then. Talk a little bit more about the 16th Amendment. Turning now to page 914 in the book. If you've ever studied the Internal Revenue Code, thank you, Bill.
Click on the trigger.
Page 914, quoting from U.S. v. Ballard, 1976 case, the general term income is not defined in the Internal Revenue Codes. Well, that's no accident. It's never been defined in the Internal Revenue Codes, and it never will be. Because of the 16th Amendment, income has been, since 1913, a constitutional term. The IRS...
A little late.
The IRS, the... I like that one. Good ricochet. The courts, the bureaucracies, they'd love to expand the meaning of income in law, but they can't. The courts basically set it down in Eisner v. Macomber, 1920. What it said, Eisner, is income is the gain come to fruition from capital, from labor, or from both combined. This is sound doctrine in both law and in economics. It becomes essential to distinguish between what is and what is not income. Congress may not, by any definition it may adopt, conclude the matter, since it cannot by legislation alter the Constitution from which alone it derives its powers to legislate, and within those limitations alone, that power can be lawfully exercised. This amendment, talking about the 16th, shall not be extended by loose construction so as to repeal or modify, except as applied income, those provisions of the Constitution that require an apportionment according to population for direct taxes upon property, real and personal. This limitation still has an appropriate and important function and is not to be overridden by Congress or disregarded by the courts. What it said was these four important things. Income, quote unquote, means profit or gain derived from its taxable source, meaning a U.S. source, a privilege. Second thing it said was Congress cannot change or enlarge that definition. Number three, Congress cannot loosely construe the 16th Amendment to circumvent the binding apportionment rule required for direct taxes on private property. And four, the constitutional apportionment rule is still in effect, important, and appropriate. What apportionment was all about, and the only thing the Constitution mentions three times, is that direct taxes must be apportioned. The only thing the Constitution mentioned twice was that trials of a criminal nature must be heard by a jury. So when you hear something hammered over and over again in the Constitution, they meant it for a reason. Direct taxes, what are those? That means the tax comes directly from you. There's no indirect middleman that you pay the taxes through, and then he pays the taxes to the government. It's called a capitation or head tax. And the Constitution says that if there's a direct tax, it's got to be per person equal. It's got to be apportioned. And a lot of the cases before the 16th Amendment, before 1913, especially the Pollock case of 1895, was talking about the Income Tax Act of 1894, was that direct taxes must be apportioned. And the 16th Amendment came about really to classify the income tax for all time from then on out as an indirect tax, so to avoid this constitutional requirement. It's nothing new that the 16th Amendment gave Congress, gave the government. It just said that the government could tax incomes, comma, from all sources derived, comma, without regards to the census or enumeration of the people. Big deal. The government could always tax indirectly without regards to the census. So basically, the 16th Amendment was kind of a hollow nothing. It said really nothing new. It gave no new powers to government. But it was an amendment. So people thought that it was something new. People thought that it gave the government something different. And it didn't. Never did. The court said so in Eisner. And there was a later case after that. Let's see if I can find it. But they really got fed up with it. Yeah, it was... I think it was a concurring opinion by Justice Pitney in Eisner. He was so exasperated with the federal government's relentless barrage on the definition of income that he amplified and emphasized to an unheard-of degree in Supreme Court cases. The government placed chief emphasis upon the word gain, which was extended to include a variety of meanings, while the significance of the next three words was either overlooked or misconceived. Derived from capital, the gain derived from capital, etc. Here we have the essential matter. Not a gain accruing to capital, not a growth or increment of value in the investment, but a gain, a profit, something of exchangeable value proceeding from the property, severed from the capital, however invested or employed, and coming in, being derived, that is, received or drawn by the recipient, meaning the taxpayer, for his separate use, benefit, and disposal. That is, income derived from the property. Nothing else answers the description. So the justices were really pretty fed up with the feds over the 17 years or so that they had to argue these sort of cases. And that's why you haven't seen a modern ruling on the word income. You haven't seen it, heard of it since 1930, Eisner. 20, excuse me. Because they settled the matter. You know, it's it. That's over. It's any more on this subject is like sawing sawdust. So they've said it. You're expected to know it, but we don't know it. That's why books like mine, other books, have had to come out over the years to re-educate us over something that's been lost 5 decades ago. We're going to take a little break now, and I'll come back and I'll talk to you more about how they suckered in new groups in the income tax scam. And talk a little bit more about why you have no moral obligation to pay, irrespective of all the semantics that we've been discussing in the law. So stick with us. We'll be right back. Here. Good evening, everybody listening. We're back. This is Boston Tea Party, author of Goodbye April 15th by the same Boston Tea Party, here on the Hour of the Time with Bill Cooper. The federal government and its income tax was limited to net profits derived from basically five people or five activities, and it always has been limited to that. Number one, domestic corporations chartered of or by the United States government. Net profits derived within the territory of the federal United States by aliens and foreign firms. Net profits derived from worldwide sources by citizens and resident aliens of the United States, meaning the federal government and its territories. Net profits derived from federal government contracts within and without the United States. If you're doing business with the feds, they get a portion of that in the form of a kickback, which they call a tax. And finally, net profits derived from wages and salaries of federal government employees. Well, that wasn't enough for them because that probably gave them $1 out of 20 that they would have liked to have received. So they had to sucker in new groups one at a time over the years. First, they suckered in profits from corporations of and within the Union states, the 50 states, 48 states at the time. Then profits from all business and investment activity within the states, not just corporations, but the mom-and-pop stores and chains. They had to sucker in the wages of the state and local government employees. That happened in 1939. Then in 1942, as I said, wages of all private sector employees were suckered in. So basically from 1942 on, one out of five developed into one out of two people in this country pay income tax on their wages to basically a foreign government. A government, if you're, say, living in California, do you pay income tax to Oklahoma? No, you don't. You don't live there. You don't work there. You have no investments there. And if Oklahoma sent you a tax bill to fill out, you'd laugh. You'd throw it in the paper, in the trash can, or send it back to them with something appropriate scrawled on it, but you wouldn't pay it. The only reason we pay it is because the United States government, through the IRS,
talk about getting your money's worth.
The only reason we pay it is because it has United States on it. And if you have my book or you listened last night, you'll understand that the United States and its internal revenue is just that. It's internal revenue.
Ready, aim.
This is good.
Fire.
Good. Yeah, I think he's down. The internal revenue is internal revenue for the federal government, period. It's a little tongue-in-cheek joke for the people that wrote all that, believe me. So, we've got the basics of wages. What are they? What aren't they? They're property, and they're not income according to the law, according to the Constitution, according to the Supreme Court. But regardless of all that, let's say you didn't know that. We've got this fair share thing, right? Your fair share of taxes are the price you pay for civilization. Yeah? How many times have you heard that? Raise your hands. Okay. That's not true. It's a myth, especially these days. The taxes the government used to get along with were excise taxes, tariffs, privilege taxes based on government-granted licenses, things like that. Basically, voluntary taxes. We still have a voluntary tax code in this country, but we're having to rediscover it. None of your money these days goes to defense. None of it goes to Congress or the courts. None of it goes to the roads, Social Security. Every penny of personal income tax goes to interest on the debt. And it still is not enough each year to pay for that interest. Government has a problem now. If you've ever been swallowed in the black hole of credit card debt and tried to pay off your MasterCard with your Visa, you'll know what I'm talking about. 82% of what the government borrows each year, this was in 1990, goes to interest on the debt. It's borrowing to pay for past interest. This is a mathematical catch-up game that pretty much has swallowed the country. There's no turning back. The debtors, of course, are us. The creditors is the Federal Reserve, International Monetary Fund, that sort of thing. Very appropriate. So, you're not paying for an orderly civilization. You're not paying for law and order. You're not paying for the roads. You're paying interest on past debt. You're paying for your own financial, economic, political enslavement. You don't have to do that. P.J. O'Rourke said in Parliament of Horrors, "Giving money and power to government is like giving whiskey and car keys to teenage boys." Buckley said, "There's nothing fair about a policy that taxes persons at a higher rate just because he chooses to drive a taxi cab 60 hours a week instead of 40 hours a week. It really is that simple." We got another good quote. Gregory V. Helvering, "The legal right of a taxpayer to decrease the amount of what otherwise would be his taxes, or altogether avoid them by means which the law permits, cannot be doubted." Folks, only we as the people have rights. Only government has responsibilities. The only responsibility we have is to be an educated, moral, and upright people. Then we can deserve some sort of democratically elected Republican form of government. But if we don't keep up to our end of this implicit contract, the government has sort of a right to take it away. It steps in the vacuum. We're going to have government one way or the other, either from without by others or from within through ourselves. Pretty soon I'm going to open up the phone lines to callers. You can ask me anything you'd like to about the subject or the book, and I'll be happy to answer as best as I can. I'll close this up with one last thought. A lot of people think that tax avoiders, tax protesters, so to speak, are sort of cheating out of something. We're paying all the taxes and you're getting a free ride. You know, you're layabouts. We're having to support you. Well, that's not true. See, the government in law, and the courts have shown this many times, the government has no specific duty to individual citizens. They only have a duty at large to provide the public at large general benefits of national defense, police protection in the local communities, but not to the individuals. It's sort of a lottery thing. You know, you win if you get help from the government, and if you don't, you can't sue them. So that's why the government is voluntarily financed. It's like a charity. If you like what the Red Cross is doing, send them some bucks. If you don't like what they're doing, don't send them bucks. If they help you in a natural disaster and you've sent them money, good. If not, they can't bill you for it. So we need to get beyond this mythology that taxes are the fair share of civilization. You have a fair share to pay. You have a load on your back that you've got to carry like everybody else. No, you don't. We've got a very different style of government. At least it was designed that way. We have the only country that was begun with an avowed moral purpose. And we've got to remember that the government serves us and we don't serve them. And it's the other way around now. We'll open the phone lines just after we get back from something, and stay with us. Talk to you soon.
Oh, my baby's coming home tomorrow. Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news? Baby's coming home tomorrow. Ain't that new? Man, ain't that new? I got a letter just the other day telling me that she was on her way and she wanted me to meet her at the station. Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that new? In the letter, she told me she still loves me. Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that new? In the letter, she told me she loved me. Ain't that new? Man, ain't that new? Said she's sorry that she left. Found out she don't want nobody else. Said she wants me all to herself. Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that new? Ain't that new? Ain't that good news? Man, I know that's good news. My baby's coming. A party at conversation. Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news?
Ladies and gentlemen, the Hour of the Time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading, your connection for precious metals in their various forms. It's the only place that I know of where you can get what you need with very little risk at all, and that is in whom and with whom you're dealing. You see, they record everything, so that there's no misunderstanding either on your part or on their part. And if anyone raises a question, just go back and play the recording. And what you said is recorded on there. What they said is recorded on there. They have a buyback policy. They guarantee your satisfaction, and I back up that guarantee with my own personal guarantee that if anything goes wrong whatsoever, I will get with Craig Smith and we'll make sure that it's set right. You don't get that anywhere else. And it's simply because they believe that what they're doing will help you. They believe that in sponsoring this broadcast, it will help you. And I believe that whatever I'm going to do, I have to stand solidly behind it. And if I can't, ladies and gentlemen, you can rest assured, I just flat don't do it. Now, I've talked many, many times about what constitutes real money in the Constitution and the United States Code under the law. And I've talked about what constitutes counterfeit money. What is the debasement of the coinage of the realm? And for those of you who have been listening to this broadcast for quite a while, you know what all of this means. For those of you who haven't been, I suggest you call Swiss America Trading and start asking some penetrating questions. And for those of you who understand the monetary system, the economy, what's coming, what's happening, what causes inflation, what causes depression, what causes recession, if there is even such a thing. And you may have some ideas of your own. And if that's the case, call Swiss America Trading. Field your idea to them. See what they have to say about it. If you're adamant, they'll help you bring it to fruition, even though they may disagree. It doesn't matter. They're there to serve you, and they will if you'll give them an opportunity. We also believe in loyalty here. And if you're someone who's benefited from the information that you've heard on the Hour of the Time, I think that you should show your loyalty and do your business with the firm that brings you this broadcast, and that's Swiss America Trading. So call now 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Do it now. You'll feel better. You'll be able to look your loved ones in the eye and tell them that they're going to be okay, no matter what happens. 1-800-289-2646, and do it now, folks. We're going to open the phones. The number is 602-337-2524. That's 602-337-2524. Right after this short break. Good evening, you're on the air.
Good evening. I'd like to ask Mr. Boston T. what the Buck Act for USCS 103 through 110 impugns for the citizens within the states.
That's a good question. We found out about the Buck Act basically earlier this year in its fullest. What it was a 1940 act instigated, I think, by Congressman Frank Buck of California. What it did was allow the federal government agencies, any and all of them, to call their administrative zones, regions, or districts states with a capital S in law. Basically, the feds, when they were created 200 years ago, they were created without children. They didn't have their own states. They were barren. They couldn't create their own states. So they're wannabes, and they wanted to have a national government across the board like other countries, but they couldn't rule the 48 states. They couldn't rule the 50 states. So they had to create this fiction of a capital S state. So anytime you read the word state with a capital S versus state with a small s, and we live in small s states, understand that they're talking about themselves. They're talking about an IRS district or a Social Security region. And it's just an example of more verbal trickery, legal trickery that they've used against us. It's one of the last nails in the coffin on this whole thing, in my opinion.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. About starting all this out, getting yourself out of the system, I was wondering if I'm on the trail right now.
Right.
And is it true that you need to get your birth certificate from these people in order to remove yourself from the corporation of the United States? It seems that they've incorporated us.
Yeah, the birth certificates are now on file with the Department of Commerce and the Census as well. They're never going to give it to you. They're never going to return it, but at least you can have on file that, you know, hey, I'm not part of your human natural resource inventory, and that's what the thing is all about. Another point about this, OF is a bad word, date of birth. You know, I've got a birthday. I don't have a date of birth. Of is a legal term, significant, because it decries something special, contractual in nature. You've gotten in bed with something. So date of birth, birth certificate, this all ties with becoming part of human natural resources. You can write the Department of Commerce and tell them that you would like it back, that you want yourself off the rolls. I don't think they're going to do it, but you know that is part of it, but don't rely on it to give you your walking papers.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. First of all, thank you for your program. I've been listening to it for some time. But I have a question. Mr. Party just a minute ago cited the example wherein you live in one state and Oklahoma sends you a bill for taxes and they laugh at you. Well, if you worked in California and then all your life and then decide to retire and you want to leave Californication and you go to another state, California will track you down and in that state's courts collect back income taxes from your pension.
I'm not at all surprised.
And they make it stick. I wonder how they do that, and I was wondering if you were aware of that.
Well, it depends on where you worked in California, what your pension agreement was. California is a very vociferous state in their government. They've got a lot of resources, and they're very jealous of their tax base leaving the state like rats fleeing a sinking ship. Being from Texas, we don't have an income tax there yet. I don't know as much about the state income tax angle on all this as some of the California tax groups do. But I would assume, I would have to state with confidence, that there has to be a way out of it. But get in touch with people local, or that were local for you in California, and I'm sure they could help you on that.
You also have to understand that California is based upon the principle of social illusion. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, how do you get out of this? I believe in the legality and rightness of what you're saying, but we have been trying to get out, and right now they're taking half of my husband's income before it even comes to us.
Right.
And so how do you, you know, do you live to fight another day, or how do you get out of this? We just stopped paying, and they are attacking us.
Was that your actions, basically? You just stopped paying? You didn't send anything in, any affidavits?
Right.
Well, you've probably had on file, since you've gotten your Social Security number and since you filed W-4s and all that, things which basically told the government, hey, I want to be a part of your system, I want to pay taxes into what you're doing. And unless you very specifically and clearly revoke those things, they have the right under law, they have the prima facie right to still come after you. So that's what a lot of my book is about. The last two chapters and part of 21 is showing people, after they've learned the basics of all this, what they need to send in. You got in trouble with your own signature and paper sent in to the government, and you get out of it the same way. It's kind of hard learning all this, and not too hard to affect it once you understand the basics. So I would say get my book and any other information that you think is viable and go from there. Write me if you've got any questions. Okay. When I was talking about wages and income, it took basically... Did we get another call? Good. Let's hear them now.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Yeah, Bill in Boston. This is John from Norristown, Pennsylvania.
Hello.
Hi. My wife and I stopped paying income tax last December. I filed a affidavit of revocation and rescission of my Social Security number. I'm not going to file a 1040 on April 15th of 1995. What can I expect the Internal Revenue to do?
Well, we think of the Internal Revenue Service as this monolithic organization, when in fact how they respond to all this is pretty capricious. Depends on which district you live in, it depends on what city you live in, what time of the year they get your paperwork. Generally, for Social Security, since you've revoked your membership in Social Security, what happens is they ignore you, and then if you write back saying, hey, I want to hear back from you, they'll say, well, you can't do this. And you write back and you say, yes, I've done this. And they usually write back saying, well, we wish you wouldn't do this. And you write back, I've done it. And they write back the third time, typically, well, we're sorry you did this. That's what I've heard of, if they write you back. Usually they don't. So just proceed, if all your paperwork is in order, just proceed with what you've started. You've claimed certain things, you've got a new life, so to speak, and start living it. If you've got any questions about my book, and if you use any of my paperwork, you're welcome to write me about that.
Good evening, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for the program. And I'm from Texas, calling from Texas.
Yes, sir.
And I have been studying this for about a year now, and I have discovered these things that you're talking about. And I've known for years it's not right, and we just quit doing it.
Mm-hmm.
They're coming after me. And I just to buy some time, I didn't know what I was doing, but about three years ago, I got an installment agreement with them just to buy me some time. And I'm afraid they're... You know, I can send my affidavits in and all that, and I'm preparing to do that. But they're probably going to try to bind me to that previous contract.
Right.
Is there a way to get out of that, to revoke or rescind that, simply because I just didn't know what I was doing at the time?
Right.
Do you have anything in your book that deals with things like that?
Basically, what you'll have to reply to them is that you didn't know what you were doing. You didn't realize the ramifications of what you were signing. They withheld material facts. You didn't realize you were waiving rights. And all this really goes back to fraud. The IRS does have a stronger case against people that voluntarily come in and sign so-called installment contracts, as you put them. They can enforce those in civil court, tax court. It's a debt you've created for yourself. There's no real way out of that unless you go back to the fundamentals. They've lied to us and they've treated us with fraud. So always remember that at the basis of your dealings with them.
Good evening, you're on the air.
Good evening, Mr. Pardee. This is Monty from Vermont.
Hello, Monty.
Hi. I'm going into court on Tuesday for a paternity suit. I know the child's not mine, but I want to protect myself. What's the best way I can do that?
In which way protect yourself?
The court's a magisterial court.
Okay, what do you mean by protect yourself?
I don't want to yield any future rights in any court cases. What would be the best step to take in that?
Well, I'd love to talk about something like that, but I don't want to skirt on the boundaries of giving legal advice.
Let me tell you a little bit about what I know. If in every instance that you believe or the court may put in front of you that requires it, you must claim and state that you reserve all rights. And if you do that, you might be safe unless they come up with something. And remember, many of us have been working at this for years, but there's also an awful lot that we still have to learn.
Mm-hmm. I've already filed a response with them stating that I reserve my rights.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder what the next logical step was once I entered court on Tuesday, what to do.
Well, reservation of rights one time is not enough. You have to reserve your rights, and you have to claim your rights every time that your rights are challenged.
Mm-hmm.
Each and every time.
And make sure that appears on the record.
Okay.
Beyond that, I would see a lawyer about that, or a common law attorney, common law lawyer. Next caller. Okay. Y'all are welcome to call in. The number is 602-337-2524.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. My name is Gary, and in 1976 I was injured, and since that time I've never filed income tax because I haven't been able to work. Now, am I off their records, or should I go ahead and file affidavits and turn in my Social Security card?
Well, there's two ways to go about it. You can let sleeping dogs lie, so to speak. If they haven't contacted you for any reason, then you might as well just let it go. In the meantime, I would do research. I would educate yourself to what all this is about. So when you do hear from them, if you do, it sounds like basically 20 years have gone by, and unless someone's reporting income on you on a 1099 or a W-99, their computer matching system is not going to catch up with you. So I personally would let sleeping dogs lie, yet in the meantime, use that valuable time to educate yourself in case they do contact you.
The number, for those of you who haven't been listening to us that long, is 602-337-2524. That's 602-337-2524. And don't forget that Boston Tea Party will be here with us also tomorrow night. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question. I'm just about to I'm getting ready to file my affidavits at the county court.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got, my wife and I have outstanding student loans from the government. How would that affect, how would that play into the picture?
Well, it does have something to do with it. You've basically gotten a privilege from the government in the form of that loan. So they might have quite a bit of stronger case against you if they can say, look, you've taken from us and now you're trying to bail out of your responsibilities. I personally would try to pay the loans off before you affect any of this paperwork.
Yeah, I do intend on paying off the loans, mm-hmm. but... As far as having any obligations to the government beyond that, is there any?
No. Once the loan is paid off, you're in and out of that. So it doesn't stick with you the rest of your life just because you got a student loan. But I would pay it off before the affidavits.
602-337-2524 is the number. That's 602-337-2524. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling from Kansas. I haven't heard you address property tax. Could you address that?
Well, I didn't talk about it in the book. I discovered pretty late on in the research and writing of the book something called allodial titles. It stems from the Roman term allodium, when someone was granted by the state land free and clear, not beholden to anyone. And we had at one time in this country a system of allodial titleship, but it's been lost. That's what the Homestead Acts of the 1800s were all about. You basically got 160 acres. You couldn't borrow money against it. That kept the bankers out of your life. You couldn't speculate on your own land. In my next edition of the book, I will have something about allodial titles, but the word is spelled A-L-L-O-D-I-A-L. Get any information you can about that. There's a book called I Wants to Own My Land by Bob Kelly at the American's Bulletin up in Oregon, I think Medford or Ashland.
Basically, what it boils down to is nobody owns what they think they own. If you look at the title of your car, you'll find out that it's a certificate of title and not the actual title or the ownership papers. Also, if you look at the deed to your house, if you paid it off, what you have is a warrant deed and not an allodial patent deed, which is required to own the house. And what it basically means is you don't really own it. Somebody else owns it, and they're holding the deed or the certificate of title, or excuse me, the title, and you're paying what's amounts to a rental payment in your property tax.
Right.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, I had a question about being in federal bankruptcy. Should I wait to get out of it before I think about, filing my affidavit?
That probably wouldn't be a bad idea. I don't know what the terms of your bankruptcy were. I don't know which chapter, if it's chapter 7 or 11. But it's probably not a bad idea because you've agreed in federal bankruptcy court to certain terms of this disposition. And it might be good just to go through that if you can, unless you can claim fraud on the part of the federal government in their actions.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello.
I
have a question. The only ties I have with the federal government have had was I paid voluntary income tax
mm-hmm.
for Social Security. I've never had a bank account. I've never had any contracts with the government that I know of.
Right.
And I filed for Social Security 3 times and was denied and with no reason. I mean, they didn't give me an answer. They said we just... Excuse me. They just said that we can't grant you your claim at this time. And I was wondering if that's the reason why, because they have no real ties to me.
No, if you've paid into Social Security on your numbered account, which you have, right?
Yes.
Well, that's some sort of fluke, some sort of problem with SSA themselves. According to their own rules and regulations, you should be entitled to whatever's comes to you on the scale at this time. So, no. If you paid into it, they've got to send it back to you. Not as much as you paid in, of course, but, something.
And you're also entitled to know why. If
yes.
you go down there and just basically ask them why, that you want to know exactly under what law or regulation or stipulation that they're denying your benefits, then they'll tell you. Remember, the people who work in Social Security aren't the ones who do all the planning and everything. They're just people like you.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll understand your plight and will usually be willing to help you out. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
I've been doing some research on this on my own, and, of course, hearing about your book, I'll be interested in purchasing a copy.
Thank you.
Let me ask you a question. For example, I just have the, I guess it would be the head page of the titles of the United States Code,
mm-hmm.
and 26 as far as the Internal Revenue Code. There are a bunch of others, and there's a distinction made between some titles are what they call enacted as positive law.
That's right.
And some, in some of them that you would think would, like, for example, banks and banking, that's not positive law.
Right.
What I haven't been able to find out is what makes something positive law versus something that isn't positive law.
Well, positive law titles must say so. Basically, positive law means that it's prima facie evidence that the title that is positive law is the law of the land across the United States and the states. And if it is not positive law, it's not prima facie evidence of being universal law across the USA.
So in the case of, obviously, Internal Revenue Code is not positive law, therefore it is not on its surface law throughout the land.
Right. You're only tangentially connected with it through your actions, through things you file. It's not a the Internal Revenue Code, and Bill has his hands on the buttons, otherwise he'd be doing the firing sound right now. The Internal Revenue Code is not a USA income tax code. It's a code that you get tricked into. It's a code that they fool you into making it touch you, basically. So read it with that in mind, and my book fully explains what all that's about.
Well, that's about all the time we have, folks. If you'd like to order Goodbye April 15th, send $43. The checks are money orders out to Annie, A-N-N-I-E. Don't put anything else on there, just Annie, A-N-N-I-E. Send it to the Intelligence Service, Post Office Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. That's $43. McChecks or money orders out to Annie. Send them to the Intelligence Service, Post Office Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. Good night, everybody.
Good night, y'all.
And God bless you all.
I want everybody to get up out of your feet. Come on, y'all. Come on. Your hands together. Get up. And your arms together. Get up. And give me some of that old soul clap. Now if you love me, I can see it. What you see, and you see it. I'll thank you. And let you kiss me. And you see it. What you see, and you see it. I'll thank you. You should be loved.
You hear right here on the Hour of the Time. We're broadcast on Galaxy 3, transponder 17, 5.80, wideband audio, and WWCR, Worldwide Christian Radio, 5.065 megahertz on your dial. Please be with us every Monday through Friday night at this same time for the Hour of the Time.